Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Orit Bashkin, Associate Professor of Modern Middle East History at the University of Chicago and author of New Babylonians, A History of Jews in Modern Iraq. Professor Bashkin's appearance was sponsored by the Father Henry W. Casper S.J. Professorship in History. She'll speak on the topic Modern Babylonians, Iraqi Jews, Arab-Jewish Identity, and the Arab-Israeli Conflict. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, November 13, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is John Calvert, Associate Professor of History, as well as the Henry W. Casper Professor of History at Creighton University.
In May 2003, just days after the coalition forces took over Baghdad, a group of American soldiers, they were assigned to search for nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. It was a fruitless search, so it turned out. They entered Saddam Hussein's intelligence building, and there in the basement, under about 4 feet of water, they found thousands of books and documents relating to the Jewish community of Iraq. These were disparate materials that had come from synagogues and Jewish organizations all over Baghdad. It was quite a find, but perhaps not surprising, and that's because the Jews of Iraq have a rich, storied past, extending well over 2,000 years all the way to ancient Babylon. In fact, up until about 60 years ago, Jews were still a wealthy and politically active component of Iraq's religious and ethnic spectrum. They numbered about 130,000 in those days. Yet now in Baghdad, the Jewish community can't muster even the 10 Jewish men required to perform some of the most basic rituals of the faith. Well, we're fortunate to have with us here today Dr. Orit Bashkin, who is Associate Professor at the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago, who is going to shed light on Iraq's Jewish population during the middle decades of the 20th century. This was really a critical period in the community's life. And this, as she'll tell us, was a time when many Iraqi Jews found themselves caught between the competing claims of Zionism and Iraqi patriotism and Arab nationalism. Dr. Bashkin is a native of Israel. She has an impressive pedigree. She's a graduate of Tel Aviv and Princeton universities. In addition to many scholarly book chapters, essays, and articles, she's authored 2 books and co-authored a third. The most recent of her books is New Babylonians, A History of Jews in Modern Iraq, published by Stanford University Press. It's received wonderful reviews. It is a real contribution to the scholarship on the topic. Here's a copy of it here, fresh from Amazon. I'm afraid it wasn't available in a local brick-and-mortar bookstore. Perhaps it should be. Rashid Khalidi, who visited Creighton to give a talk a few years ago, has this to say about the book. This remarkable book examines the tragic modern history of the most deeply rooted Jewish community in the Arab world. With empathy, careful historical analysis, and great rigor, Bashkin avoids the many potential pitfalls of such a charged topic. This book should be welcomed by all who seek to free themselves of the blinders imposed by extreme nationalism. So please join me in welcoming to Creighton Dr. Orit Bashkin.
Thank you very much, John, for this very generous introduction. And thank you all very much for coming. I'd like to begin my talk with a woman called Rina Dangour. She was elected to be the Iraqi beauty queen in 1947. Now, in 1947, it was very clear to everybody who knew anything about Middle Eastern politics that the conflict in Palestine between Jews and Arabs is going to be long and bloody. And yet it is at the exact same moment, 1947, that a middle-class Jewish woman is chosen as the beauty queen of Baghdad, is chosen to symbolize the beauty and the splendor of modern Iraq. So in this talk, I'll try to unpack the circumstances that gave birth to Rina's success and more broadly talk to you about the history of the Iraqi Jewish community and what happened to them after their arrival to Israel. Now, I'll be talking today about a class of a particular class of Jews, about middle class Jews, or what I called in the book the Jewish effendia, professionals, educated men who enter the Iraqi middle classes and become a very powerful force in the nation's economy, culture, literature. Now, I will be talking about a period in Iraqi history called the Hashemite period, which is a period where Iraq is a constitutional monarchy led by a king called Faisal. In the 1920s, it's under British control. In the 1930s, it's formally independent, although the British are very much involved in Iraqi politics. And this is the sort of the middle class. This is the period where I studied the Jewish middle classes. But it's important to note that Jews entered the middle classes, the upper middle classes, already under the Ottoman period, where the Ottoman Empire controlled Iraq before World War I. They benefited from reforms that occurred in the Ottoman Empire, specifically from French education provided by a French Jewish school called the Alliance Israélite Universelle that was located in Baghdad, run by French Jews, and provided French education to middle-class Jews. But again, in the 1920s, especially in the 1930s, the upper middle classes in Baghdad become very important. I want to point out to Salima Pasha, or Salima Murad. She was one of Iraq's most famous singers in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. She was Jewish. And the people who wrote songs for her were very famous composers in Baghdad. And again, she was considered to be a national symbol, a woman who was very much involved in the nation culture, in the nation's culture and music. Now, I wanted to also take notice of the classes that this talk excludes. The poor Jewish classes, the urban poor that you see the women you see here, a poor Jewish neighborhood. You also see how the dress codes are different, right? So the woman wears a veil in a similar manner to Muslim women. The women here are called Kurdish Jews. They lived in northern Iraq. They spoke Aramaic, a dialect of Aramaic, but in their clothes and in their features, they resembled more their Kurdish neighbors than the urbanized elites in Baghdad and in Basra, and to some degree in Mosul. So I won't be talking about these communities, but it is very important to remember them. Now, Iraq as a state is formed in 1921, and in the interwar period, in the period between the two world wars, we have several narratives of Iraqi nationalism. The elites living in Iraq, the Arab elites, the Muslim and the Christian elites, are coming up with narratives that sort of bring together the different inhabitants of Iraq. The Sunni elite that controls the country, but also the Shia, and to a certain extent, the Kurds. One such national narrative was pan-Arab unity or pan-Arab nationalism, meaning that Iraq is an Arab country. Arabism, Arab culture, Arab history, Islam is an essential part of Iraqi nationalism. And in fact, Iraqis should strive to unite with neighbor Arab countries. And in this narrative, there were a few components. One important component was secularizing the Islamic past, meaning that Islam was not only a religion, it was also a culture and a civilization. And therefore, anybody who spoke Arabic, knew the history, could be part of this secularized Islamic culture. So Muhammad is not a religious man who established a religion. He is also the leader of the Arabs, who gave the Arabs a glorious book in Arabic called the Quran. Salah ad-Din, who fought the Crusaders, is a national hero. The Shaheed is a martyr that dies for the cause of the nation. And this narrative was very prevalent. It was taught in school. It appeared in the press. And Jews actually used this narrative to claim a role in Iraqi nationalism. And when I said Jews, I mean Jewish journalists, writers, authors of short stories, of poems. And they're arguing Jews have been playing an important part in Iraq's life since the days of ancient Babylon. Jews have been writing in Arabic. They're mentioning a pre-Islamic Jewish poet in Arabia called As-Samawa al-Ibn Adiyah, who wrote in Arabic. And significantly here is sort of the narrative about rise and decline that is prevalent in Iraq. So as Arab nationalists, the prevalent historical narrative was that the entire Arab community declined under the Ottomans, who were Turkish, and now it was about to rise under Arab independence and sovereignty. So unlike in Europe, where the assumptions of many Jewish intellectuals were that society progressed and Jews somehow remained at the back, in Iraq the perception was that both the Jews and Muslims, as well as Arab Christians, were kind of in a period of decline under the Turks, and now it is an era of emancipation and liberty for all Arabs, awakening from Ottoman rule or from the Ottoman yoke. And so this became, again, a very important narrative. And I just wanted to show you a poem that was written in 1964, so very, very late, and after the majority of the Jewish community already migrated to Israel. It's written by Anwar Shaul, a Jewish journalist, and this is what he says. "I take my faith from the religion of Moses, so I'm a Jew. Although my home is the creed of Muhammad." So I live in an Arab land, and therefore it is the creed of Muhammad. "I take refuge in the tolerance of Islam. My tongue is the language of the Quran." So I speak Arabic, and therefore my tongue is the language of the Quran. "I treasure my love of the nation of Muhammad." So again, I live in Iraq amongst Arabs, so this is the nation of Muhammad. "Although I chant the prayers of Moses, I shall be loyal as Samawal." So this is this pre-Islamic Jewish poet who wrote in Arabic. "Whether miserable or blissful in my beloved Baghdad." And I just want to make a comment about this, that I'm friends on Facebook with a number of groups that are sort of nostalgic to good old Iraq. 2 weeks ago, this poem was posted in Arabic, and it was amazing the amount of responses of Iraqis today who wrote how wonderful this poem is, how proud they are that this poem was produced in Iraq. And this is from 2 weeks ago, not from the 1960s. Now, this love of Arabic didn't appear out of the blue. It was actually cultivated by the state in Jewish schools and in public schools. More Jews went to public schools. More Jews went to private schools. But even in private schools, the state insisted that Jews would be taught Arabic and Islamic history by a teacher appointed from the state. And this teacher was often Arab Muslim. Some of them were even non-Iraqis. They came from Egypt and Algeria. Also in this period, because Baghdad expands, more Jews leave the traditional Jewish neighborhood and live in mixed neighborhoods. So here is a testimony of a Jew called David Nagar, where he talks about why he loved Arabic so much. So he says, "I greatly love the Arabic language, which is the language of the Quran." So again, the connection between Arabic and the Quran. "My love for the Arabic language probably originated from the fact that I was a Jew born and raised in a mixed neighborhood of Jews and Muslims, and I used to hear the muazzin, the person in the mosque, call for prayer several times a day. So notice here the significance of the mixed neighborhood. He lives with Muslims. He hears the call for prayer from the mosque, and he's curious about this language, which he studies in school and actually likes. Now, this incidentally is written in Hebrew. The poem was written in that I read you was written in Arabic. This is written in Hebrew in Israel, and he still, this particular individual, talks about his love of Arabic. Now, taking a pan-Arab position towards politics by the elites, not only by children, also had important significations politically. And here, the elites in Iraq, at least in the 1920s and 1930s, were very much anti-Zionist. They were afraid that the conflict between Arabs and Jews in Palestine would project onto the Iraqi scene. So if in Palestine there is a Jewish national movement that says we deserve to have a homeland in Palestine, and the Palestinians resist it, and there are further tensions, such developments might endanger the situation of Iraqi Jews who, again, tried to position themselves as Arabs. And they were using this word, Arab Jews, or Arabs of the faith of Moses. And so this is a quote taken from a British document written around 1929. I won't read the entire quote, but this is a time when there's a rebellion in Palestine of Palestinians against both Zionists and the British mandatory rules. It's a very violent conflict, but the Jews of Iraq try to distance themselves from events in Palestine, and in a particular moment, they also arrive to a mosque and sort of saying, we have nothing to do with the Jews in Palestine. We are together with the Muslims. We want to remain sort of on good terms with them. This became even more important in 1936, 1939. Now, again, the major conflict between Jews and Arabs in the land of Israel, what was called then Mandatory Palestine, what we know today is the State of Israel under British control. That 1948 was sort of the major moment where Israel is established and there's a war between Israel, the Palestinians, and its Arab neighbors. But all throughout the 20s and 30s, there are clashes between Jews and Arabs in Palestine. And they sort of reach a zenith in between 1936 and 1939, where, again, there are skirmishes, demonstrations, strikes in Mandatory Palestine. In Arabic, it's called sort of the Arab Revolt of Palestine. And in that year, in 1938, Jews publish a petition in an Arab newspaper called Al-Mustaqbal, where they write, "We, all Arab Jewish youngsters who work on behalf of Palestine, our Arab sister nation, pronounce our determination to preserve the Arab nature of Palestine and the rights of her Arab sons. We support with our hearts and souls those who defend a strong Arab Palestine." And this position was also accepted by Muslims. So this is a dialogue that is published in a satirical journal edited by a Muslim editor called Nuri Thabit. And it records a conversation between two Iraqis who hear that the Jewish community in Palestine boycotted the Jewish community in Iraq. So this is the conversation between the two Muslims, as imagined by the Muslim editor of the newspaper. So again, it's a Muslim newspaper written in Arabic. And this is a conversation, an imagined conversation between two Muslims that he published. "Adon Schwartz, who is he? A Zionist. Published an article in the newspaper Haboker regarding the declaration of Iraqi Jews that they disassociate themselves from Zionism and said that the declaration caused much pain to the hearts of the Zionists. May a thousand pains befall on their heads." And then their friends reached the conclusion, "The Jews of Iraq are Iraqis before anything else, and prefer their country to the rest of God's lands." Now, this was, to me, studying the Iraqi community, it's not so much a statement about Zionism as it is about the patriotism of Iraqi Jews. They are loyal to Iraq, this Muslim editor says, not to the project that goes on in Israel. Now, in addition to this kind of pan-Arab notions, again, emphasizing Arabic, sort of a secularized version of Islam, in this period, we also find notions of Iraqi patriotism. So people loyal to Iraq as a territory. And these visions include not only Arabs, but also Kurds, Turkish-speaking people who live in northern Iraq. And they emphasize Iraqi tribes, Iraq's history when Iraq was not part of a glorious Arab empire, pre-Islamic empires like Assyria and Babylon, and the Iraqi landscape. And you see it in particular in art. Now, Iraqi Jews also take part in this kind of patriotic discourse. In Arabic, it's called Wataniya. They are very proud of, again, the fact that they've lived in Iraq for 2,500 years. And they speak about Abraham, who originated from Ur in Iraq, as an Iraqi prophet. In Iraq, there were 50 shrines of Jewish prophets, most notably the shrine of the prophet Ezekiel. But there's also a shrine for the prophet Jonah, there's a shrine for the prophet Nahum, so it's all over the country. So they were using these shrines as kind of attestations to the fact that they've been in Iraq for a long period of time. And there's a key moment here when Faisal is appointed king of Iraq. And there's a gathering where the Jewish leadership comes to greet Faisal, and they give him the Jewish Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, the most important book of Jewish law that was written in Babylon. And when they give it to the king, it doesn't become just a book of Jewish law. It's become an artifact produced in Babylon, given to the king by these modern Babylonians, by these new Babylonians who are now identifying with Iraq's ancient history. But the major kind of vision is articulated in this cartoon. It says in Arabic, "Innama al-Iraqiyun ikhwa." Iraqis are brothers, and you have here a priest, a Muslim imam, and a Jewish rabbi, and they're all saying Iraq is one nation. The Jewish rabbi even curses the one who says that there is a difference between the Iraqis of various faiths. So that's the message. That's the sort of vision that intellectuals wanted to have. Again, this is taken from a newspaper edited by an Iraqi Muslim, not by a Jew, and the year is 1936. I've mentioned before the role of Arab education, but what is kind of, getting an education in school about the significance of nationalism, being exposed not only to Arab nationalism, but also to foreign languages, to global commerce, makes Jews in Iraq more secular. You might think that this is sort of common central, but this is very important to make in terms of the history that ensued after, where Iraqi Jews were presented as being extremely religious and also liberated from their conservative religiosity in Israel. But actually, when you read the debates in Iraq, you see that Jews were secularized already in Iraq, partly because the society around them also went through important processes of secularization. So this is a testimony from a school kid called Georgi Barsham, who talks about how he detested going to sort of a version of a Jewish day school before he moved to the more westernized school. In the first class, the teacher taught us about the Torah. He continued doing so in the next classes. I thought to myself, learning Torah all day? What about the other professions about which I heard from the children of the neighborhood, like math, geography, Bible, and history? So he still wants to learn Bible. But he doesn't want to learn the Torah all day. He wants to go to a school where he can learn about math and geography as well. This was also very important in terms of women's education. There was a French school for girls from 1893 in Iraq. And in this period, again, women's education expands. The community, by the way, I forgot to mention, we're talking about something like 150,000 Jews in 1951. So here you see images of Jewish girls, girls playing ping pong in the Allianz School, and also vocational education. It was very important for philanthropists from amongst the Jewish communities to have poor girls trained as seamstresses or give them some profession that will enable them to integrate into the job market. And so Jews write about, amongst their publications, about the need to get rid of outdated Jewish practices, like dowry, like arranged marriages, like girls who get married at a very young age. And there are also clashes between rabbis and Jewish intellectuals, more secularized Jewish intellectuals. But the important thing is that because Jews feel that they're part of a larger Arab Muslim society, they also write about things that are important to the entire Muslim population of Iraq. And one such thing was honor killings. So among certain tribal societies, and this practice sadly was adopted also amongst rural societies, sometimes in urban communities as well, there is this notion of honor crime. If a woman is suspected of basically having sex before marriage, then her parents or her relatives murder her in order to cleanse the honor of the family. And the notion that this practice has to disappear and immediately was a cause for Iraqis, men and women alike, progressive Iraqis in the 20s, 30s, and especially 40s and 50s. It was also taken as a position against the British because the British supported tribal leaders who actually said, you know, this practice could continue to a degree. Some tribal leaders, not all. And so here we have a Jewish writer by the name of Ya'qub al-Bul who writes a story about against honor killings. And the story is about a midwife taken by two brothers, one of them is called Aziz, to inspect whether their sister is pregnant. She finds out that the sister is pregnant and the sister is murdered. Now, the characters are not identified by religion, but if you know the Iraqi scene, you kind of figure out that they're Muslims. And he writes a story sort of condemning this. And here is a quote about from the story. And this moment is where the sister is about to be butchered, and the midwife is trying to talk to the brother about it. The midwife answered Aziz whilst her compassionate gaze still focused on the poor girl about to be slaughtered in front of her eyes. So this is what the midwife says. Yes, she's pregnant. I say by Allah, she's a poor girl. Have mercy on her. I plead you in the name of Allah and the prophets. Have mercy on her. Allah does not agree to such a thing. And so here the Jewish author is speaking in the name of the Muslim midwife, saying to Aziz, but also to fellow Muslims, this is not about religion. Allah doesn't agree to this. The prophets are against this. This is something else. And in the story, the brother says to the sister, say your last prayer. Say there is no God but Allah. Yet the girl remained frozen. So the girl refuses to say the last prayer. And literary critics who commented on the story published in 1938 said that this was a very powerful commentary, that the girl that is slaughtered in the name of a very misguided understanding of Islam is telling her brothers, by her silence, what you're doing to me has nothing to do with Islam. But again, the significant thing here is that a Jew is writing about that, that he feels integrated enough into the community that he can write such things to fellow Muslims. Now, in the 1940s and 1950s, many Iraqis, Jews, Christians, Muslims, young Iraqis, move leftwards. One of the reasons for that, especially amongst the Jews, is that in the late 1930s, certain pan-Arabists supported cooperation with Nazi Germany. And so that kind of nationalism was tainted in the eyes of many Jews. Also, following the failure of a pro-German coup in 1941, there are urban riots in Baghdad during which 170 Jews are killed. And I talk about these riots in great length in the book. Unfortunately, I don't have time to talk about them now, but I'll be happy to talk about them in the Q&A. The result is that a lot of Jews, again, turn leftwards. Remember also, it's after 1945, the Soviet Union is perceived by Jews as the liberators of Jews from Nazi oppression. And so this becomes a relevant option to young Jews. This is a police account from Baghdad. This is a young Jewish girl who's arrested by the Iraqi police. Her name is Doris. She's a teenager. And they ask her why she's a communist. And she says the following in her confession to the police. I like the Communist Party. Saida, my niece, used to tell me about communism. I participated in the last demonstration. I read about the execution of Fahad, that's the leader of the Communist Party. I used to talk to Saida at home because my sister did not allow me to go outside the house. She taught me and my nephew Fuad, who's now arrested. When talking about communism, Saida used to tell me about the class of workers and peasants who do much for the country, and therefore we should help them. I do not read any books because I do not read well. Now, the last sentence is actually a lie. She read quite well, but she's under police investigation. The last thing she wants to do is to associate herself with printed materials. But the important thing here is that you see from the police account this kind of context of a Jewish family where you have one female cousin, who sort of tell her younger cousins, you know, there's something in this nation about workers, about peasants. We should do something about it. Again, this had political implications. The Jewish communists, like other communist organizations in Eastern Europe, were very critical of Zionism. And you have here a statement from a society called Usbat Mukafahat al-Sahayuniyya, the League for Combating Zionism, a society that was active in Iraq in 1946. And the basic argument of the society is that Jews are not a nation. They don't have a shared language. They don't have a shared mentality. A German Jew is different than an American Jew. An American Jew is different than a French Jew. And the basic idea here is shared culture, shared language. Iraqi Jews are part of Iraq because they speak Arabic. And in their minds, they recognize the fact that there is anti-Semitism in Iraq. But they said, if we join the workers, if we create a class-based revolution, then the entire Iraqi nation is saved and anti-Semitism disappears. Now, remember also that the Jews were not the only community discriminated against in Iraq. The Shi'is were not represented in government. The demands of Kurds that their language and culture be recognized were also extremely problematic. So there were also Christian minorities in Iraq. So when they're articulating these demands, these anti-sectarian demands, they're actually speaking in the same language that many minority groups in Iraq were talking at that time. There is also a Zionist underground in Iraq. And again, it becomes Zionism is legal in Iraq in the 1920s. It's illegal in the 1930s and early 1940s. But after these urban riots and after Zionist emissaries arrive to Iraq, you sort of get a Zionist underground in the 1940s. And here is one account of a Zionist girl in Iraq. Now, interestingly, the Zionists kind of share the same profile of the communists. They're young, they're radical, and they're extremely critical about certain phenomena that they see in Iraqi society. The gaps between rich and poor, the discrimination of certain religious groups, But their solution is different. They identify the flaws that they see in Iraqi society, not with Iraq itself, but with what they understand to be the Jewish exile or the Jewish diaspora. Now, in Zionism, the assumption is that Jewish life in the diaspora is doomed to fail, and the only way in which Jews can redeem themselves and can attain social justice and feminism is in the land of Israel. So the flaws that they see in Baghdad, they identify with Jewish life in the diaspora. This is a letter from 1949 by a girl called Violet Shamash, a Zionist, and this is what she says. I thought that the Jews in the world are like the Baghdadi Jews, egoist and weak. I'm certain that not only I felt that way, but all Baghdadi Jews whose self-honor has not died yet. Then came our brethren from the land of Israel to save us from slavery and explain to us the Zionist ideal and the difference between the Jew in exile and the Jew in the land of Israel. And there's another letter written by a woman called Margalit, who was already in a kibbutz in 1949, to her parents who are in Baghdad and considering immigration to America. I was surprised when I found out that you wish to go to America. Do you think Jews are better off there? If you think so, you're certainly in the wrong. Although it is quiet there now, anti-Semitism is rooted deep in the hearts. Wherever a Jew goes, he's a Jew. Who knows when will riots against the Jews of America begin? There are all sorts of phenomena in America that we, Jews of Iraq, are familiar with and live through. Why would Americans and the English not go after the Jews? Is it because they are the people of culture and learning? The Germans were men of culture as well. And here, again, emerges a very important difference between the Zionists and the Jews who identified with Arab nationalism. Jews who identify with Arab nationalism or Iraqi patriotism used to actually say that Islam was very tolerant to Jews, and argued that, look, in Europe they have all these pogroms, the Spanish Inquisition, there was a long list of examples that they could be using, but they were saying, you know, Jews flourished under Islamic rule. We had far less problems under Muslim rule than we had under Christian rule as Jews. Now this is changing with Zionism. Now it doesn't matter where you live. You live in Iraq, you live in Yemen, you live in America. Anti-Semitism is about to appear at some point. And Germany, post-Holocaust, is the example. The Germans were cultured as well, and look what happened there. So I will not get into why Jews immigrated to Israel. Again, this is something I talk about in the book. Broadly speaking, Jews become sort of pawns in the Arab-Israeli conflict. They actually do not negotiate their faith, their property. This is decided on in clandestine negotiations between the Iraqi government and the Israeli government. Israel really wants to get them to Israel and take some acts that actually endanger Iraqi Jews. On the other hand, Iraqi right-wing activists are saying, you know, every Jew is a Zionist, these guys are traitors. The government adopts certain legislation that marked all Iraqi Jews as Zionists. Many Jews lose their positions in Iraq. There are a few executions of Zionists or suspected Zionists. And in many cases, it was clear that the people who were arrested were neither Jews, were neither communists nor Zionists. And sometimes people were blamed for being communists and Zionists at the same time. But the important thing is that they felt that they were trapped. And many of them arrived to Israel. A legislation was passed in Iraq that froze all their property, even which meant that they had no access to their bank accounts, to their to things that they left behind in Iraq, and many of them arrive penniless to Israel. They don't speak Hebrew, most of them, and they also face racism in Israel. Now, imagine a society that has, the Israeli society, that just emerged from a war with the Arabs. 1% of the Jewish population was killed in this war. The country is faced with waves of immigration, Holocaust survivors, Jews from Arab lands, all flock Israel. And the state has no financial means to absorb them. In addition to that, Jews from Iraq come. They speak Arabic. Some of them look like Arabs. And they are, so all of a sudden you have Jews, some of them are Zionists, but their culture is Arab, their language is Arab. So there's a lot of efforts to sort of absorb them into Israeli society. But again, I bring a quote that was actually written about North African Jews in most part. It was a quote that was condemned by even people like David Ben-Gurion, but it reflects a certain racist assumption that was, sadly, in Israeli society of the 1950s. So this is 1949. This is a journalist by the name of Aryeh Gelblum. This is an immigration of a race we have not known in our country. We're dealing with a people whose primitivism is at a peak, whose level of knowledge is one of virtually absolute ignorance, and worse, who have little talent for understanding anything intellectual. Generally, they're only slightly better than the general level of the Arabs, Negroes, and Berbers in the same regions. In any case, they're even at the lower level than what we've known with regards to the former Arabs of Israel. These Jews also lack roots in Judaism, as they're totally subordinated to savage and primitive instincts. As with Africans, you will find among them gambling, drunkenness, and prostitution, chronic laziness, and hatred for work. There is nothing safe about this social element. Even the kibbutzim, so this kind of socialist villages, will not hear of their absorption. So again, this is a radical example, but it speaks to a few contexts. One is the fact that, you know, Jews came from Israel from all over the Arab world. Yemen, Egypt, Iraq, North Africa, and for the European elites that lived in Israel, they didn't know much about these differences. Now also, Iraqi Jews, when they were again, as I mentioned, they came with virtually no money, found themselves living in transit camps. They're called in Hebrew ma'abarot, tents and shacks. It took them a good 10 years to get out of them. Now, many middle-class Iraqi Jews figured out that if they stayed close to big cities in Israel, they could actually get a position as trained professionals. So even if the state said, you know, we will send you to the northern part, to the Galilee, or to the southern part, to the Negev, they were like, no, we want to stay at the center. So for them, this was a tactic of survival that eventually proved very effective. But as far as state officials were concerned, this was considered ridiculous. The state offers you a house in the Galilee and you want to stay in the tent. Now, also in these camps that were virtually refugee camps, sanitary conditions were horrible. People who once lived in, you know, very beautiful houses all of a sudden lived in these conditions. And again, the Israeli press didn't know how to deal with these communities that spoke Arabic, that lived in these poor camps. And so this is another report from Haaretz, a very prominent journal, reporting about a camp like this in Tabarias, so north of Israel. Sun, noon, everybody's resting. Only the cafe, the Star of the East, a shabby cabin, the social center of the people of the transit camp that numbers 4,000 people, operates relentlessly. In one corner, around a deck of cards, sits a group of long-mustached young men whose hair is gelled and whose shirts are colorful, like in Chicago. Now, this is not about in Chicago. Nothing wrong with the shirts worn in Chicago. But the people who are writing it are, in part, you know, responding to this idea that you have to dress modestly. And so these guys with mustaches and gelled hair are not sort of in line with how you're supposed to dress. Everybody, despite the sweat dripping from them, is immersed in an intense game of poker. Others simply grab above cups of coffee, arak, and smoking cigarettes and talk loudly. All above this commotion and the clouds of smoke filling the cabin rises the shrilling voice of the Damascene singer Fairuz. Women with wild hair. So then they talk about a riot that happens in the camp, and they write, and the reporter writes, women with wild hair stuck their heads through the windows to the place of the fight and started howling in an oriental fashion, calling their husbands and their brothers to help their slaughtered brethren. Now again, the riot in this camp is not important. What is important is sort of this construction of a place as an oriental spot within Israel, as an oriental site or space within Israel. Now, actually, Iraqi Jews, and for that matter, Jews from Egypt, from Yemen, from other places, really tried hard to find work. It wasn't easy, especially if one wanted to find work in one's own profession. Sometimes they were also taken to sort of works that were really useless, but just for the point of educating them that it's worthwhile to work in a sort of socialist society, as Israel perceived itself to be at these days. But again... people in Israel at the time who were not from Iraq, who didn't know, for example, that Iraqi Jews were westernized, that they spoke Arabic, but they were also bilingual. They spoke English and French, and they read a lot of the masterpieces of European literature and culture, but in Arabic translation or sometimes in the original. So the image that they got from the press is that. And by the way, Fairuz is not from Damascus. She's from Lebanon. This is a letter sent from an Iraqi youth in a kibbutz. I'll just read the first lines. Arabs, ignorance, black. Did you ever see a movie? Did you eat with a knife and fork? And other such expressions, Jews from the land of the East, hear from the members in the kibbutz. And I just brought you this letter to mark that now being affiliated with an Arab is shameful. It's like being black. It's like not knowing how to read and write or not knowing how to eat with using utensils. I want to end with actually a hopeful note. So there were, you know, during the years, the 1950s, when Iraqi Jews found themselves in Israel, there were a lot of protests. People tried to survive. And again, eventually, amongst many communities who came to Israel, Iraqi Jews actually successfully, in most part, integrated into Israeli society. But there was also a group of Iraqi Jewish intellectuals who tried to sort of convince fellow Israelis that not all Arabs are their enemies, not Iraqis and also not the Arab Palestinians. So there are a minority group, but from this group emerged a very important group of novelists and writers who are influential in Israeli society even today. I mean, they're not, you know, ministers or prime ministers, but as intellectuals, their voices are heard. And one of them is Sami Michael, who is a Jewish intellectual. He's Israeli. He publishes novels. And in the late 1950s, he published the following article about the Iraqi Jewish relationships in Hebrew. And he writes the following. As a Jew who lived 22 years in Iraq, I saw that the oppressors of the Jews in Iraq were not the people. This thing is not possible at all because the enemies of the very same people, the Iraqis, are the one that oppressed the Jews. I lived in Iraq, worked with Iraqis, and fought together with the Iraqi people. I know them. Iraq's sons are good and brave. In their bitter and difficult life, they yearn for peace, brotherhood, bread, and democracy. This is the 1950s, but Mikhail remained loyal to this project. And again, I think that the whole history of Iraqi Jews, with the horrible migration that they had to go through, with the many difficulties they encountered, also makes us think about the fact that Jews and Arabs did not always sort of represent opposing parts of the same opposing part in a national conflict. There were Jews who thought themselves, who thought about themselves as Arabs, who enjoyed Arab culture and Arab music and Arab drama, who wrote in Arabic, who cared deeply about Arab subjects. And we should not project the realities that we see today as part of the ongoing Arab-Israeli conflict onto the Jewish past, which is much richer, thicker, and sometimes more interesting. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bashkin, for a fascinating lecture. We have time for questions, and I would ask that if you have a question, please approach the microphone at the front. Don't be shy. We want to make sure that everyone can hear the question.
Can you talk a little bit about the circumstances that prompted Iraq's Jewish population to leave for Israel?
Thank you. So there are a few reasons. One, which I've mentioned before, is that in 1941 there is a coup in Iraq, and orchestrated by pro-German officers, Iraqi officers. And they decide that it's a good idea to collaborate with Germany, partly because Germany was the enemy of Britain and France. And so, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so they orchestrate this coup. And Jews, although they are fearful of the coup's power, they actually serve in the military, but they're very nervous. Now, the British are afraid of this coup, and so they immediately send armies to Iraq, and they occupy Iraq. So the coup starts in April 1941. By June, the British reoccupy the entire country. Now, in June, it seems that everything is okay. The leaders of the coup are gone. They leave Baghdad, and there are a few days where there are no sort of British powers, no powers in the city, just the mayor and the police. Before the British entered the city, on the first and the second day of a Jewish holiday called Shavuot, Jews sort of go out, some say to celebrate the holiday, some say to welcome the pro-British forces coming to the city, and they were attacked by a Muslim mob, and a few are killed. And that instigates a whole line of attacks against Jews. There are policemen, some army officers, but the Jewish quarters, especially the poor quarters, are being attacked by soldiers returning from the battlefield, the urban poor. There's a lot of looting of Jewish property. Now, what's interesting about these riots is that what you have mobs attacking the Jewish neighborhoods because it's the urban poor, it's soldiers and so on. But also you have Jews who risk their lives to save their Jewish neighbors. And the number of Jews killed, according to my estimate, in mixed neighborhood is much smaller than the ones who are killed in purely Jewish neighborhoods, precisely because the Muslim neighborhoods actually defend their Jewish neighbors. And so the Farhud, as this event was called, created a shock in the mentality of Iraqi Jews. But we also know that after these riots were over, a year after, the Zionist movement sent delegates to Iraq and saying to Iraqi Jews, come, we will get you, we will... At the time, you couldn't just immigrate to Palestine under British control. You had to get a certificate from the British. And those were hard to come by, A, because the numbers of people allowed in had to be limited because of demands of the Palestinian populations. Don't bring these refugees in. It would lead to our eventual demise and so on and so forth. So, but there are a number of permits that are available to Jews, and the Zionists tell the Iraqi Jews, you know, we will give you these permits, just come to the land of Israel. And Iraqi Jews, especially the elites, refuse. They're sort of saying, we don't want it, we want to stay in Iraq. And then the economic situation improves, conditions improved. And so, you know, that event remains a horrible event. It's in the memory of the young generation, but it doesn't push to mass migration. Then the war in Palestine happens between Jews and Palestinians. So The war actually starts in around 1947, when the UN decides in November to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict by creating a two-state solution, a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Palestinians are unhappy with the borders created, given to them by the UN decision. They feel that they misrepresents their claims, their demographic situation, and then sort of battles between Israelis and Palestinians begin already. In May 1948, Israel declares itself as a state. The Zionist movement says, we're in Israel, there is a state. And then begins a war between not only Israelis and Palestinians, but also Israel and its Arab neighbors. Syria, Jordan, Egypt, Lebanon, and so on. And Iraq joins the war. Now, what happens in Iraq is that once Iraq joins the war, there is sort of a military rule. And the state is very, very worried that there might be a Zionist underground. Now, there is a Zionist underground, but it's not as important as the state thinks it is. And in order to deter Jews from becoming Zionists, the state kind of unleashes a campaign against the Zionist movement, which targets not only Zionists, but many Iraqi Jews as well. And the thinking behind it was like, we will make sure that these guys will be so afraid that they will not even think about Zionism. But it actually backfires, and then a lot of Jews are saying, look, the state fires us, we're all of a sudden being identified with this national movement. We are being now treated as second-rate citizens. Now, the State of Israel begins to negotiate actively, one might say too actively, about the plight of Iraqi Jews to leave. There are demonstrations, there is concern for Jewish property in Iraq, there is talk about persecution, but what happens is that, again, it's never discussed independently. So when there are claims about what happens to the Palestinians, immediately the Iraqi Jewish interest, the Iraqi Jewish situation is being raised. So all of a sudden, the state of Iraqi Jews is connected to what's happening in Palestine. Finally, the Iraqi state sees the Jews begin to migrate illegally, and they take their money with them. So they sort of say, this has to stop. And they sort of say, okay, we will let Jews leave as long as they declare that they give up their Iraqi citizenship. And the assumptions amongst Iraqi leaders, Muslim leaders, is that, 10,000 would leave, nothing more. But because of, again, executions and the feeling of Iraqi Jews that they are marked as Zionists, the numbers that leave are much larger. Now, within this whole mess, there are two synagogues. There are explosions in six centers of the Jewish community in Iraq, including in a synagogue. This pushes Jews to migrate even further. Now, up until today, there is a debate who bombed the synagogues. Some of the documents about it in Israel are not available for investigation. Zionist historians claim that it's the Muslims who did it. Muslim and Arab historians say, no, it's Zionists, they did it in order to scare off the Jews to migrate to Palestine. Now, the situation with the synagogue and the bombing is kind of highlighted in the historiography as the event. But again, it's part of a much larger context.
Well, I think we've taxed Dr. Bashkin sufficiently, a real tour de force.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Orit Bashkin, Associate Professor of Modern Middle East History at the University of Chicago, and author of New Babylonians, A History of Jews in Modern Iraq. Professor Bashkin's appearance was sponsored by the Father Henry W. Casper S.J. Professorship in History. She spoke on the topic, Modern Babylonians, Iraqi Jews, Arab-Jewish Identity, and the Arab-Israeli Conflict. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, November 13, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.